Good afternoon. All right. I'm Reverend Mel Hoover and a board member of the UU Ministry for the Earth and a friend of our key speaker. And he's really been a major part of my life and my work in Unitarian Universalism and justice work and thinking about things and trying to look at the cutting edge of things. And so I want to ask you a question. Why did you choose to come to this workshop this afternoon? Not answer it out loud, just think about it. What motivated you, and what are you hoping to learn? Think about that for just 30 seconds. Kind of put a telegraph in your mind about it. A little telegram. You got it? What do you do with the telegram once you've written it? I want you to send that message to someone around you. Talk about what you just wrote on your telegram. Just quickly. Share it with somebody around you. So were you surprised by what you heard, or did you kind of get a sense that you all were pretty much on the same page or have some of the same hopes? So you can stay in the room. Okay, just checking. One of the things you might want to know is why did UU Ministry for the Earth want you to be here this afternoon? Well, one of the reasons is that we have some stories to share in several different ways. And to invite you to say yes to yes. Yes Magazine, which is going, Fran Corton, the other partner, these two people are such an extraordinary team and a gift to our country. And I think they have told us and given us and opened the doors to stories through Yes Magazine in some unique ways that most members of our congregation know about. Fran Corton, would you come forth, please?
Such a yes guy. So I'm Fran Corton, and I just wanted to tell you that I'm going to be passing out an email sign-up sheet, and I just wanted you to know what it is. So I'm going to pass these around. There's some choices. You can sign up for Dave Corton's newsletter, which is a very infrequent newsletter. It will not jam your email box. And you can sign up for the Yes This Week, which is a weekly lift to your spirits every Friday afternoon. I highly recommend it. It lifts my spirits with solution-oriented stories and news about the things that we all share, that we care about. I also want to mention that out in front, I have a kind of smallish number of magazines to give away. I have this Together with Earth issue that really lifts up the ideas that Dave will be talking about change the story and change the future. And then I also brought some of our current issue about Black Lives Matter and the healing journey we all need to go on as we face the traumas, current and past, of race. So I ask you not to take two, but only one. because I have a little screw up with the UPS people and I didn't get the number of magazines that I had hoped. So with that, let me thank Mel for allowing me this little moment and turn it back over.
And let us thank you. One of the other treasures with us today is the president of UU Ministry for the Earth. And she wants to tell you why she wanted you here. And so, Irene.
I wonder how many of you know the slogan of Unitarian Universalist Ministry for Earth. That doesn't fit on a business card very well. I'm sorry. It's pretty long. We have a slogan coined by one of our former presidents of the nonprofit named Barbara Ford. Respect life, restore earth, renew spirit. And I have to say that the planning for this workshop has renewed my spirit. To have the opportunity to learn from Mel Hoover and especially from David Corton, to read and reread the latest book, Change the Story, Change the Future. I was too embarrassed to bring it here to get his autograph because I've written all over it. It so resonates with our seventh principle and gives us a way to embody that principle and have the enthusiasm we need and the heart and the judgment we need to do the work that we all know we face. Besides, they're really nice guys, and it's fun to laugh once in a while and to feel gratitude when the work seems so heavy. So Ministry for Earth is just delighted that we had this connection. And I simplified our slogan among some friends the other night, and I said, and I think it will probably be true of most of you in this room because you walked a long way to get here. I felt like I was in Idaho. I coined a simplified version. You care, you connect, and you act. And to understand why we care, we do need to look at our story. And these gentlemen will help us understand a little better how to write our story. So I'm glad you're here. You give me the juice to work the rest of the year by being here and sharing your stories and your heart.
Just to kind of get a review of ourselves, we kind of did this as a connected presentation, our time together. It so happens that David, in fact, we were actually together about a year ago and visiting our daughter and called Fran and Dave and said, hey, guys, you got time for lunch? And David said, you know, I'd love to see you guys and Fran can see you, but I'm too busy because I'm working on this book and I'm really excited about it. And so I apologize, I can't make it. I said, but David, I got to tell you about this GA that's coming up and it's going to be climate change. And several years ago, if we would talk about Unitarian Universalists sponsoring a GA on climate change, wouldn't have believed it. Trust me. We offered this several years ago, and Louisville was the first time that we got the board and the planning committee to hear that climate change and abstraction issues were not regional issues. They were universals. And Louisville was the beginning of some consciousness, some story beginning to change in our own midst. And here we are today with climate change as our common focus. And it so happened when I talked and told David what we were trying to do, David said, well, would you mind if I changed my mind and came to lunch? I said, I don't want to hear what these UUs are trying to do now. And out of that came, change the story, change the future. And you know what? Seldom does so much wisdom get packed into these pages. And I mean that. And it's not just about a moment in time. It's also about David's time and sorting things out. And the learnings and the journey as an individual, but also in seeing with his great eyes the collective change that's happening within our world. Now, some of you know, and a lot of UUs have used this. I was one of the founders of UUs for a Just Economic Community. And many of those folks tried to raise issues around economics and justice and stuff. And so David, again, was a resource for many of us. I headed the justice work, some of you know, for Unitarian Universalists for a number of years. And this was a great resource for us. It is called When Corporations Rule the World. Have some of you read it? All right. You like it? All right. Has it been useful? All right. Well, David said, well, guess what? I think by June, we're going to have an updated 20th anniversary edition available. And this is kind of this launching, helping get this out. It's through us, folks. We're launching the 20th anniversary edition. That's pretty cool. Be among the first to know about it. So we said, let's talk about the principles and the insights and understandings in changing the story, change the future. And then let's ask ourselves, why did he need or believe he should write or have an updated version? What did he learn or what's changed that we need to know about to help us in our work and to help us more accurately assess what's going on in the world? So that's how this came about. So we said, we're gonna start this, we're gonna talk about cosmology, we're gonna talk about stories, and then we're gonna talk about reality. Isn't it remarkable? Me, who was actually hired in 1987 to be the director of urban and international programs, with my charge being helping us become an anti-racist faith. And we couldn't even use the language then. And we had to figure ways to teach a vision and help people think about a future while we grew into it. David's been trying to help us think about a world and to understand principles that I think maybe the world is a little more ready for to hear, and desperately needs to hear. So that's why we're here. So we want to do some sharing, we're going to do some things. And I asked David a question. I said, David, what's your story? You got a story. How did you get here? Just tell your story a little bit, and then let's help us think about how we do and can learn a larger story, a more cosmic story. Does that feel like a good thing to do? Well, let's do it.
Thank you. It's such a wonderful welcome, and it feels like I'm in a room full of close friends and longtime friends. You know, it's one of the wonderful parts of being an author, the people who read your work, it just feels like you're connected. And of course, such a long time connection to the UUs. And the fact that we have so much work to do together, and that this is a faith community that has consistently rolled up its sleeves to deal with the deepest problems facing humanity. Mel talked about When Corporations Rule the World, which first came out in 1995. And it's interesting, at the time, many people said picked it up because they were wondering, what's this guy saying? Is he saying corporations do rule the world, or is he saying they're going to rule the world, or what's going to happen if they do, and so forth? That was part of the magic of drawing people into it. At this point in time, 20 years later, no one asked that question. We all know that corporations rule the world. The interesting thing is, as I went back through reading the original edition, that the analysis remains absolutely spot on and changed a bit. It's just gotten worse. The awareness has grown, and of course we have massive numbers of resistance movements and alternative movements, people working to create an alternative economic system to displace that system. And that, of course, is our sign of hope. Now, at this particular moment in time of the 20th anniversary, it is clear that we are at a point at which we absolutely must get control of our economic lives and our political lives, and that we must end corporate rule and reclaim democracy. Now, to accomplish that, we both, of course, have to understand the system, why it is so deeply dysfunctional. But I've also come to realize that there is a deeper set of issues, a deeper story, which is, in a sense, our ultimate human story. But even beyond our human story, the whole story of creation, addressing the deepest questions of where do we come from, why are we here, and what's it all about? What's the source of meaning? These all sound like, yeah, okay. We all ask those questions. I don't think we often reflect on how profoundly important and significant they are. Now, Mel suggested that one way to get into this, keeping it personal, we each have our personal story. And my particular path, along with Fran, is a way of getting into these framing issues of what we're up against and why. And it's kind of the path of my own awakening. Now, as many of you know, Fran and I started out back in the 60s with a sense that we were aware of poverty in the world. And we decided to commit our lives to addressing the problems of poverty in the underdeveloped countries. And we started out setting up a business school in Ethiopia, and over time, we worked for 30 years in international development, first in Africa, then in Central America, and then ultimately 15 years in Southeast Asia. And over time, we began to realize that quite the contrary, that the economic development models that we were helping to take abroad and that we had believed in originally were actually having a very different consequence. They seemed to be, in some places, they were creating some very wealthy people. They were creating something of a middle class, and that all creates a facade, so it may look like development is working. But what we realize is you look beyond this facade and you see people living ever more deeply in desperation. We saw the environment being trashed. We saw the hillsides being denuded of trees, the rivers growing with pollution, the coral reefs, once rich with fish, becoming underwater wastelands. Now, I came out of a business school background. Some of you know I taught on the organization faculty at the Harvard Business School. Fran and I both taught at the Harvard School of Public Health for a time. My field was organization. Now, a couple of things in business school. One is what I was taught as a student, is if something's failing in your organization, there's a breakdown, your sales are not working, your customer complaints or whatever, you got to deal with that problem, but most of all, you need to look upstream, look for the systemic cause of the failure. There's a system failing. And part of my experience was breaking out of the conventional frame of looking within the business organization or corporation, but really looking out in society. Why is society failing? And what we began to realize came right back to the corporation. The corporation is an institution. It is an institution legally designed to allow for the concentration of power, concentration of wealth, virtually without limit unless there are legal constraints, all under unified management. So what we were seeing was a consolidation of ownership, of economic control, under the framework of a few hundred very large global corporations. You know, I want to make a point of language. We often refer to them as multinational corporations. That's a propaganda term. It makes it sound like they're local everywhere. They're actually transnational or global. They are not local anywhere. They're not accountable to any set of people. So we began to focus on that, and that, of course, led to writing. Well, eventually Fran and I realized that we needed to come home. One of my colleagues from India, this is kind of an example of how a simple conversation can change the course of one's life. Smita Kothari, who is a very well-known Indian intellectual, at one point sat me down. He says, "Dave, we know you and Fran came over here to help us, and we appreciate that. But we think you're beginning to see what our real problem is." And of course, he was referring to the policies promoted by the United States of America that were promoting corporate globalization, a recolonization of the world's peoples and resources, all in the name of development, democracy, and freedom. And we did indeed decide that we needed to come home, ultimately started Yes Magazine. I wrote When Corporations Rule the World, and became part of the International Forum on Globalization, which was part of a network of some of the leading, most vocal activists in the world who were addressing this particular set of issues. And we helped to create awareness of that problem. Now, as I worked further on this, I was gradually drawn in to a recognition that part of what's behind this are our deepest stories. Now, you know, we talk about stories at many different levels, talk about the importance of stories. We rarely step back and recognize how fundamentally important our stories are to how we live and organize as people. If you go to the deepest level of reality, it is so complex in terms of, you know, you get into quantum physics, you get into the organization of living systems, the whole organization of matter, the organization of life, the organization of every aspect of our being, of what we experience as reality, is so complex, so far beyond even our most advanced human understanding, that we have to relate to it only by approximations, by stories. Some stories are more accurate than others in terms of representations of reality. We've gotten badly stuck as a species in some stories that are badly outdated and badly inadequate. And they leave us vulnerable to manipulation, political manipulation. And these are the deeper issues that the book Change the Story, Change the Future deal with. One of the experiences that really oriented me to the power of our stories, how many of you know the name Marcus Borg? Styles himself a Jesus scholar. He passed away a bit ago. In 1999, just before the WTO demonstrations in Seattle, the Seattle Council of Churches, Washington State Council of Churches, put on a conference to orient the faith community to what was going to be coming up in terms of those demonstrations. Marcus and I were both on the program. And Marcus's framing statement burned itself into my consciousness, had a huge influence. Very simple statement. Tell me your image of God, and I will tell you your politics. Tell me your image of God, and I will tell you your politics. A very simple frame. In the Christian Bible, there are two images of God. One is the patriarch. The other is spirit. The patriarch, all-knowing, all-powerful, sets up a frame of dominator hierarchy. Who is closest to God? Frames a story of empire. The other is the spirit image of God. Spirit manifests in all being, sets the frame for democracy. We are all connected. We are all manifestations of the same essential spirit. That is a frame for organizing a society in which we work and live together. Now, I'm going to say a little bit more about cosmology as we go deeper into that. Now, let's go back to the WTO demonstrations. That was a massive historic event because that was a breakthrough in consciousness about the abuse of structural adjustment policies by the World Bank and the IMF in terms of the recolonization of developing countries, but it was also a realization around NAFTA and other supposed free trade agreements that are really corporate rights agreements that were doing the same thing to the supposedly advanced countries that they were doing to the poorest countries. And that demonstration, which shut down those negotiations, both sparked awareness throughout the world of the issues at stake, but it also gave people a sense of courage and possibility that we can actually stop these negotiations, these sellouts of democracy, working people, and nature. So then, that massive demonstrations erupted all around the world and shut down meeting after meeting, where the elites gathered to divide up the world and rewrite the rules to favor corporate domination. Then came 9/11 and a massive crackdown. You know, we were right in the midst of this, and, you know, Yes Magazine, and we were working with Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover and others to maintain a recognition that we absolutely have to maintain a position of protest, even though our government was cracking down on any form of protest as support for terrorism, and that was spreading around the world. It was almost like we were on the verge of a shutdown of democracy entirely. We broke out of that, but it did disrupt the movement. Vandana Shiva was visiting shortly after that. You know Vandana, probably the world's greatest activist, one of my extraordinary heroes. Anyhow, Vandana said, you know, the movement is in disruption because we organized around the framework of opposing corporate rule and the expansion of corporate rule. Now we're talking about naked empire. We're talking about Pax Americana, imposing peace, America imposing peace and democracy on the world by military force. Right. She said, we need a new framework, a deeper framework that encompasses as well conventional empire. That inspired me to write The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, which is partly inspired by Rian Eisler's work on the earliest civilizations and the emergence of empire. But also within the frame of recognizing that we need to move toward a true Earth community as outlined in the Earth Charter. Now, you get into the empire frame and you realize that...
Does everybody know what the Earth Charter is?
Does everybody know what the Earth Charter is? Oh, so few. Okay. It came out of the 1992 Earth Summit, which, you know, on environment and development. And it essentially is a statement that we must honor Earth, recognize that we exist only as a living Earth community, and that requires a fundamental rethinking of our human relationships with one another and Earth. And that is very much the frame that we need to be bringing forth now. Now, you recognize that, you know, according to Rian Eisler's frame that I was building from, was the idea that the earliest human communities, so far as we can tell from the archaeological record, tended to be relatively peaceful on the whole. They tended to be more gender balanced. They were not necessarily organized on dominator hierarchy, and they were not necessarily based on one community or one nation dominating and invading, controlling another. But then we had about 5,000 years ago, building in the Middle East, structures of dominator systems with a king or emperor on the top and everybody else on the bottom. And the one kingdom, city-state, invading others to expand their domain, because of course, as you're organized by a dominator hierarchy, to maintain the system of domination, you have to control ever more resources to maintain those structures of power. So you're constantly moving out. Now, part of what's interesting, and when you put it in that context, you begin to realize that over the thousands of years, there are strong patterns of how the few rule the many. Number one, you control the story. You control the story. And fairly characteristically in those dominator systems, the big story centered on a male god. For a time we had Mother Earth and Father Sky, but we gradually got rid of Mother Earth, separated more and more from nature, and we had simply Father Sky and the dominator system coming back to Marcus Borg. The second way you maintain power is by keeping the masses divided against each other. So, okay, one easy way to do that is you divide the races against one another, pit people against one another by their color, or by their gender, or by their religion, or by any other classification that we can use to divide people. So they're all competing against each other rather than recognizing that, you know, you're the source of my problem, rather than no, it's this dominator system that is the source of all our problem. Third thing you do is you gain control of the means of living. You want to be in control of the land, the water, technology, energy, whatever people need to frame their living, you want to control it. Now, it's kind of interesting. You put that together, and you realize that in our current situation, we've got the corporations, they're paying think tanks, buying universities. Even just reading a book about how corporate interests started buying up religion back in the 1930s to make sure that some leading preachers were assuring us all that capitalism is God's way. You're all been aware of that, right? Capitalism is God's work. in terms of keeping people divided, we have our identity politics. Actually, you know, some leaders in the women's movement drew my attention to this originally. You know, much of the women's movement, much of the civil rights, racial movements, were all about eliminating the glass ceiling on the ability of a particular group to rise to positions of power. In essence, removing the limitations on the ability of any particular identity group to become an equal opportunity exploiter in a dominator system. So, in the end, that maintains the dominator system. And part of what we're moving to now is an increasing recognition of the merger, the integration of movements. That most all of our movements, our peace movements, our civil rights movements, our women's movements, our movements for the environment, they actually all are the same movement. And it's about the deep transformation of society to deep democracy, to recognition that for society to work, we must recognize and organize as one Earth community. That rather than glass ceilings, we simply need to eliminate the dominator system so that we're all sharing in the bounty. And we're all focused not on the exploitation of life to increase our individual power and money, but rather bringing ourselves as a whole into balance with a living Earth. Well, we're gonna get into that. But I want to reflect on this. We're all looking for what's the answer. What do we do? What's the magic bullet? And Michael Greenman's going to talk a little later about the move to amend, and there's just a whole bunch of things we need to do. But the critical message I want you to leave with here today is that unless we understand the deeper source of the problem, and unless we address the story, the framing story that holds us locked into the existing system, we will fail in our efforts to achieve the deep change. We will just keep fighting against each other and remain in the same system. So, I recognize the frustration. Okay, what do we do? But my primary agenda in this session is to bring ourselves into the deeper story. Now, in this part of our session, we want to focus on the deepest stories, on our cosmology, and I want to outline quickly our cosmologies, and later we're going to get into what are the framing stories, what I call the sacred money and market story that we actually organize around currently, and how that contrasts with the sacred life and living Earth story. But I want to start with the foundation. This is, this is part of what I think is so key to Unitarians, because Unitarians are seekers. You have principles, and we have the principle, the seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. That is a deeper frame for the theme of this particular conference, building a new way. Respect for the interdependent web of life, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Absolutely foundational. Now we're going to come back to a cosmology that brings that all together. But I want to start with the three cosmologies that are most familiar to those of us from Western civilizations. three basic stories. One is the distant patriarch that I mentioned earlier in regard to Marcus Borg. Essentially, the most predominant story of the Abrahamic religions. Then there is the grand machine story of Newtonian physics and science, which is still the story that much of science kind of continues to be stuck in. I got a lot of respect for science, but it also gets stuck. And the third is a mystical unity story. Now, I'm going to touch on each of these three stories briefly in relation to three themes. Agency. Where is the source of initiative, the source of intelligence, the source of direction that moves the overall system? And we're talking here about the system of creation, the unfolding of creation, how that happens. Within the distant patriarch story, all agency resides in the distant patriarch, the distant god. Second issue is relationships. What are our most important relationships? And the third variable is meaning. What is our purpose? What is our source of meaning? Why are we here? To what end? So in the distant patriarch story, God is agency. My most important relationship is my relationship with him. And meaning is about my understanding what he wants so I can get on his good side and get a good place in the afterlife. Now kind of think about that, the implications, and of course that sets up the hierarchy, as I mentioned before, who is closest to God, and then there's the kind of Calvinist idea, well, if all is by God's will, those people who have wealth and power must be the God's most favored. They are his chosen, yes. So then we go to the second cosmology, the grand machine. It's all like a clock, a giant clock. The universe creation playing out toward a heat death as the great clock spring unwinds. So agency, there is no agency. No one's in control, there is no intelligence. Relationships, well, yeah, everything's related, but only like the gears grinding out in the great clock. Meaning, no meaning. Now you think about that. Wow. It's all just a big machine. Life is nothing more than an accidental outcome of material complexity. Consciousness is an illusion. Free will is an illusion. You know, if you really get into that story, you could get really depressed. So I think I'll go shopping. Then you get the mystical unity story, and its most common teaching, often associated with Buddhism, is that all reality is an integral spirit. That is the only reality. That what we experience as the material world, material experience, is simply an illusion born of the ego. And the ego is the source of our suffering because it is the source of our separation. Is the source of violence. So the answer is to meditate, to go deep into myself, transcend, eliminate the ego, to meld into the oneness. So in a sense, everything's related, but there is no relationship, because if there's only one, you have to have at least two to have a relationship. There is no agency, it just is. And neither is there particular meaning. Now, none of these frames give us a strong framework or reason to engage in this world, to in fact create a world that works for all. know, we could go further into taking these apart. This leaves us adrift without a sense of direction. Now, hope lies in an emerging new cosmology. Some of us call a living universe cosmology. And we have different variations of it. But the variation that makes most sense to me is that we start with the spirit, the consciousness, and intelligence. So complex, so mysterious, way beyond our human comprehension. But we can kind of think of ways to think about it. Now, I sense that this spirit, well, that we reflect the drive of this spirit, which is to know itself by becoming, through expression. And that in this desire to know itself, to express, it burst forth into this great cloud of energy that science talks about. And this is the interesting thing about the way science actually describes creation in contrast to the story of the clock winding down. Because as it tells, science tells the story, the whole of creation and the creative unfolding is far more like a seed bursting forth and growing into a great flowering tree than it is like a clock winding down. And as you look at it, there is an arrow to creation toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. Well, that's kind of an interesting frame. Toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. Now, I'm sure you've all heard the story told out. This gaseous cloud, these energy particles began to join together to form more complex particles, and those particles formed atoms, and then more complex atoms, and then molecules, and then there were the formation of the gathered together into great stars, these huge heat engines that then created ever more complex particles and spun off planets and formed into great galaxies and on and on. And then on one of these planets, a planet we call Earth, a form of carbon-based life formed. Just the simplest of cells. And yet these cells came to populate Earth. And by some mysterious process, they worked with the geological processes of Earth to transform the conditions on this planet to create an environment, a surface, with conditions of atmosphere, chemical composition, water, climate patterns, and so forth, unlike any other planet we have yet discovered in the entire universe. And part of this process was extracting excess carbons and toxins from the environment, from the surface, and sequestering them deep underground as part of creating these conditions that made humans possible. Now, this creates a very interesting context for thinking about our current economy, which is organized around taking those toxins and carbons out of the ground, releasing them back into the environment to control and suppress the very forces of nature that are essential to our own existence. And why do we do that? To make money for people who already have more money than they have any possible use for. And we consider ourselves an intelligent species. Now, there's nothing in this that I've said that you don't already know, but we do not hear this story expressed. And as we lay it out, it gives us a framework for thinking at the deepest level about the nature of the change we have to navigate, the importance of that change, and begins to give us a story within which to address these deeper changes. So we're not just saying, well, you know, we've got to protect the panda bears or we've got to stop climate change and so forth. It is a deeper story that we are living beings, born of and nurtured by a living earth mother, herself born of a living universe, all of which is a process of unfolding intelligence, learning, creativity, in which every being is a participant in and contributor to that unfolding. You get a sense of the potential meaning in our existence and lives? If you think about what is our human potential, our human capacity and possibility of contributing to that continued unfolding toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility, rather than organizing as we currently do to reverse the whole process. So I want to sit down with my friend Mal, and we'll chat a bit about this. And we're coming up pretty close to where we need to take a we'll need to take a little bio break, but we can. Yeah. Okay. So we'll begin a little conversation. Maybe we'll open it up, and others may want to comment and have questions. And then after our break, when we come back, we will start focusing much more on the practical implications. What does it mean for how we rethink the economy, how we reorganize? And also, of course, what would be the role of UU congregations in crafting and communicating the new story that is the foundation of our hope for a human future? Whoops, no, this is not the break. This is not the break. Don't go away yet. I'm just trying to lay out the framework so you know what we're doing.
Well, let's actually go back. Are we a faith system? Is Unitarian Universalism a faith system? Yeah, are we a faith system? Are we a religion? I mean, do we have a cosmology? Oh, I will say, as I was listening to David, I'm saying, where do we place ourselves in those stories? Did anybody else wonder about that? When we try and talk about ourselves and try and talk about our faith? And why did you want to come talk to us about this? I mean, you said a little bit, but, you know, was that that new phase or what? Because we don't feel like we're the old stories. Do we? We don't think we're just robotic. Pardon?
We come from an old story.
We talk from an old story.
Yes. Okay. And so I think if we're going to talk about this a little bit, do we have clarity of ourselves? Well, maybe we just go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Ask it.
Somehow, if we're going to have this conversation...
Why don't we do that? Just because I'm sensing some readiness to talk about it. There is a mic there, and if you have a question, too, why don't we get a couple folks who, as we're talking about this, to clarify it for ourselves, it seems that might be helpful.
Yeah.
For what you heard, and what are you thinking about as you heard what David was talking to us about. Go ahead.
So someone said, we are from an old story, and what I think about for myself is I've lived through each of those stories as I've matured and thought about my own spirituality.
Okay. Go ahead.
You mentioned earlier something about bringing Unitarian Universalist into all of this. Well, we talked about the seventh principle, which is really a very remarkable thing. But there's another side to it, and I think that as you were saying that there's no known planet, anything like the Earth, well, I think that gives the Earth inherent worth. And I think inherent worth is a Unitarian concept. So I think that we may need something like that. It's just like the deep ecology movement, which talks about wilderness having intrinsic value, which is basically, I think, the same as inherent worth. So we have to recognize the inherent worth of not only man, but the non-human world and true wilderness. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that because there's a powerful implication to this frame of the living universe and a living Earth. And thinking about Earth as a living organism, there is an intrinsic worth, but it goes beyond that. It's not just that it is intrinsically worthwhile, it is all part of the unfolding adventure. And our task is to find our place and contribution to that. I mean, let's put it in a little different frame. Part of understanding life is understanding that life, in fact, only exists in community. Now, part of our misdirection in our stories is the limited biological story of Darwinian competition, you know, which puts it all in the frame of, you know, I mean, biologists mostly focus on individual organisms, individual species, and then they may get into the interaction between two species or between two organisms and how they compete and all this sort of thing. The thing that's only beginning to emerge in biology is the concept of superorganisms. We're talking about mostly as ant colonies. But you go way beyond that if you begin to think of Earth as a superorganism. The organization of all the trillions of species and organisms together, working with the geological processes to create the conditions essential to the life of the whole. So you begin to think of us in that context. So it's not, you know, it's not we want to protect the panda bears because they're cute. It's because all of these beings are essential to our own existence, and the existence of all is essential to this continued creative unfolding, which seems to be the purpose of the entire universe and creation. So we're used to, you know, we're so used to thinking about our existence as having no meaning, no purpose, being mechanistic, that it's kind of hard to grasp the true wonder, the extraordinary implications and meaning of this new frame.
Yes, sir.
In framing what you are trying to say, okay, there is the biological evolutionary process which we can build a frame. Then there's a cultural process that you can build a frame. When you ask about the religion, is it cultural? Yeah, it is more like cultural. It's not biological, it is not evolutionary. So we have two frames here, and I would like to hear more about the relationship between these two frames from you.
Well, this is part of understanding the complexity of both creation, but also the extraordinary complexity of human beings. We are, of course, biological beings, and we're shaped partly by our genetic materials. Now, one of the frontiers of science, in my view, the real cutting edge frontier of science, is science coming to terms with how little science actually knows. And as you know, kind of claim that we can, you know, be understood by our genetics, but scientists only even claim to understand about 2% of our genome and what its functions are. And we're beginning to get speculation that maybe it involves, some of those other genomes or even ancestral memories. They're where we accumulate our learning as a species. But we're just beginning to figure that out. Now, the other piece is that while genetically and biologically we're much more complex, much of our behavior is in fact shaped by culture and our cultural stories. And so when we think about our nature, our human nature, I think of our human nature is that our nature is that we can be just about anything we want to be. And we make those choices through our stories. So we know absolutely that we have an incredible capacity for violence, mutual destruction. Not only harm to one another, but harm to the whole of Earth. I mean, that is proven beyond doubt. What we tend to ignore is that we also have a capacity, and I think it's the what's really programmed into us more, the capacity for compassion, for caring, for mutual responsibility, to organize as a community, to create the life that works for all. And, you know, I think about it, contrary to what we're told, I mean, if you're an individual that most of your people you know and relate to are totally individualistic, mean, violent, cruel, uncaring, we really need to reach out and get some new friends. I mean, you know, think about within your own circles. What is the distribution between people who are fundamentally caring and those are people that you really wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley? Those ladders are, for most of us, a minority. I mean, I'll talk a little bit about when I talk about the money and markets story, you know, part of that fundamental frame is that we are all selfish, individually acquisitive, and materialistic. Now, the person who is incapable of compassion, of accepting responsibility, of not just being individualistic and greedy, those are the characteristics of a psychopath. And in our economic story, we set that up as an ideal.
I'll recognize the gentleman here.
Thank you very much for your words. I need help from a preteen or a teenager, or perhaps an RE director here. Which one of the principles is it that we encourage anyone, anywhere in their spiritual path to grow? Which principle is that? Okay, there's the answer. The point being that we are in the choir here. Mm-hmm. And there's a heck of an awful lot.
Sorry, more. Some people just didn't hear the answer. So, the answer is which principle is it, right? That's what some people. It's the fourth principle.
It's the third, fourth, whatever it is. Somewhere. The point being that we're free and responsible search for truth. There it is. Thank you. I'm truly an RE director. But the point being that we're here amongst the choir, and there's really a large community outside that we also need to reach out to, and not everyone is on our same page. And when we're reaching out, trying to encourage people to think about their impact on the environment, we have to understand that they're all coming from different stages of their story. And when we reach out, we need to communicate with them in such a fashion that it's meaningful to them.
And I would think that's true. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think one of the interesting things for us is that as I've experienced our faith, our intellectual awareness of our principles is very strong. Sometimes disconnected from the living out of the lives that we do on a day-to-day basis, because we're growing into some of that. And I think part of it, David was raising a number of points, I think we have historically been more of an individualistically focused faith and lifted up as part of our identity. Am I right? We are growing into being more collaborative. That kind of development, we were talking about the cells and the development and getting more mature, and that's happening in our faith. I mean, one of the things I remind people is we're only 60-some, you know, we came into being when? In terms of Unitarian and Universalism, the entity, the structure we are now, 1961. And in some ways, we're you know, maybe we're no longer an infant, we're no longer a kid, we moved to another level, but we're still young in the world. And I'm beginning to see signs of some stability or some sense of identity that we actually can begin to claim more commonly. Does that make sense? And if I begin to look at our justice work, I said to David, one of the things that's interesting, see, I don't yet think a lot of our folks have fully understood the journey we've been taking collectively. I'm not sure if we do. And as a minister and as somebody who's done the justice work, I think we've gotten a greater understanding of that first principle, which is what? Worth and the inherent worth and dignity of all people. Now, I don't think we're perfect, but I honestly believe we've made significant progress there. I also believe that our principles have carried out our values and the way of being in the world have had an impact on the culture. I think we can celebrate what happened today. And I think we can say we had something to do with that in terms of a faith system. Do you, right? Now, we didn't get there overnight, but we got there a lot faster than some other folks in religious communities were able to get there. And part of the reason is because we had relationships. We got to know people. We got to be able to deal with taking rid of those silos and the barriers, those things that keep us from seeing the family, that keep us from seeing the wholeness, the oneness. Our culture isn't there yet. But that doesn't mean we don't need to be there, and it doesn't mean that we don't need to get outside our walls being there. We may have a distinctive role at this moment in history, because we carry that sense of respecting the worth and dignity of all people, not just talking about it, but what? Making it real. Now, the other end of that schedule, now I'm not saying we're perfect on everything, but we've done some pretty good work. Now, the other end of that spectrum, I often hear you say, and we're part of the, we believe in the interdependent web of life. You know what? What's the other part of that phrase? Of which we are a part. If we don't put that together, I mean, one of the things is, like I say this as one of the ones who helped promote it. I love our phrase, on the one hand, standing on the side of love, right? And that's become kind of, it's bubbled up through us, and it's a wonderful way. We've invited people to, but you know, there's a difference between standing on the side of love and standing in the midst of love. You hear the difference? And I think we're learning that. We're growing into that. And that's not normal in our culture for people to really stand in the midst of love for all folks. And now we're being challenged to not put the hierarchy in place, which David again lifted up. We're being asked to be a part of the creation. And that the creation is dependent on us being a good part of it. Now, that's not something everybody grasps. Or am I just foolish? So we have something still to learn by growing into it and modeling it as we have in terms of our identity issues and our dignity issues. So we're at a critical moment in time when I think the kinds of things David is talking about is trying to lift this necessity up for all of us to survive upon Mother Earth.
Have we got enough time?
I can't answer that. But what I do know is we don't do some of those things to make a difference. We won't. I don't know if I can win this race, but I want to run it. And so that's what I can do something about. I can only find out later. But if I don't start the race, I know the answer to that. So that's good. I want to just, David, you want to? I see a couple hands. I want to honor the couple voices, and then we're going to shift a little bit.
Okay, briefly. I guess one of the issues that I think that Unitarians are especially in a good place to begin is as we start talking about changing the story. My understanding of cosmology from the Native American tradition, it's about bringing the spirit down, embodying those values that you believe in. And I think one of the areas where we could do a lot of growth is there are processes, there are skills that we need to learn in order to move from being an individualistic society, culture, and perhaps even religion, to moving to a community-oriented ones. And those things are already in place, but we have to learn how to embody them. And I'll put just a little bit of a plug in for a book that we have at the UUJEC table that at least begins to talk about embodying those processes, and it's called The Turning Chronicles. Thank you.
Say it again, please.
The Turning Chronicles.
The Turning Chronicles. And we can get it. You mean UUJEC? I mean, UUs produce this?
I wrote it. I'm on
board. Now, full confession, and it's okay, because it's a good resource.
But we do have it at our table, and it's bigger than my book.
I know, it's also a good resource, and it's a part of coming out of our understanding and our culture. Very important. Yes.
Oh, this is so impossible, because it is so complex. Okay, we've been working on this hard in our church, and part of the problem is that we have had 8 interim ministers over 9 years. Wow. And because of that, they could not work on our social justice and support us that way, because that's not their mission in our church. So what we did was go to interfaith groups, and we have been tremendously positive and involved in our community that way, which is a big plus now as we are finally organized and ready to move. We just voted that as a UU community this year, and we're going to make it longer, believe me, we will work on the environment and all the aspects of it in our church and reach out to the community. So now we're kind of in a good position. But my problem is I need to understand this new framework and telling a new story, because that's got to be the way to go with all the people in our congregation who love to write and who can write incredible things, who can produce movies, who can produce, our kids can do incredible things. And you know that. You watch those bridging ceremonies and you just know what can come. So it seems to me we've got such potential here, but we need some guidance. And frankly, I love that what the Pope just did, but I am appalled that the Unitarians and the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians and didn't get together and do it already. Yeah. And that's who I want to hear from, is those ministers.
Amen. Well, I tell you what, anticipate, as some people might believe, we want you to know that there's a resource that can help you in your congregation. There's a study guide for this work, because we know that when you walk out of here, you won't remember all the wonderful things and the good things, but if you got the essence of it, you can bring that into your congregation. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, the basic framework of what I was talking about, and then the connection with the economy that we will pick up on after the break. Part of the change the story, change the future, a living economy for a living earth. If you go to my website, livingeconomiesforum.org, livingeconomiesforum.org, and look for the page on the book, which will be easy to find. You'll find a study guide that you can download, or discussion guide, and it's designed for book discussions within your church, or your congregation. And I think we're going to be discussing ways that particularly Ministry of Earth may be supporting development of study guides, discussion guides specifically tailored to UU congregations. And of course, what's significant here is that, at least by my understanding, it's a fundamental precept of Unitarianism that to study, explore your stories, deepen your understanding. And so this is a mechanism, an instrument. So I'm not presuming to have the story. What I'm articulating is bubbling up from many, many different places. And we must make this a collective project. One of the things I've become very conscious of is part of our problem as a species was we have no institutional spaces for examining our deepest stories. That most of our faith institutions are locked into whatever story they were founded on, and they're still flogging that story, no matter how out of date and how partial it may be. And our universities are all siloed, and most of the individual disciplines are stuck, again, in outdated cosmologies. And one of the only places that's going to break through is in Unitarian churches, I think, or Unitarian congregations. It's one of the most likely places where we can have this breakthrough conversation and take it wherever it goes, drawing from all the different sources of human knowledge and understanding.
And I'm just going to, I know we'll try and get you as the last question, and then we're going to take a break. I think one of the things I said before is that one of the things that I've noticed that's happened in our faith, we actually talk to other faith folks, and we join them in our justice work. Isn't it interesting we begin to think about that in terms of them trying to look at the value pieces of, that can help all of us live? It can open new grounds for conversation. There are lots of folks in other faith groups that want to save the earth, that don't want to die. So there's a potential opportunity for us to engage. And one of the things that we make a claim that other faith groups don't, revelation is not sealed. That truth continues. It's not locked into the past. It's not forever one way. As new data comes in, as new information, as we mature, as we evolve, then we become revolutionary in trying to change consciousness. That's part of our identity. That's part of the gift we can bring to other parts of the religious community. And I think, quite honestly, to a lot of young folks who don't show up in churches for service, but might come to talk about this. Yes, I want to get the last question, and we have an announcement that's very important. And then we'll take a break for a bathroom and going around. But we really want to give you a chance to come back and talk about this in terms of how we can make it real on the ground in some other ways. Yes.
Thank you so much. And building on the comment of the person who, the comment that was made prior to me at the microphone, why weren't our Unitarian ministers there first with the message that the Pope just put out? Well, maybe it's not too late. On September 24th, the Pope will be addressing a joint session of Congress in Washington, D.C., and will most likely be carrying the message of the encyclical. There will be tens of thousands of multi-faith individuals on the mall, holding vigil, marching, witnessing to Congress, where one-third are Catholic, and trying to create this turn, create this shift. The Unitarians that are in the Washington, D.C. area are preparing to host events and build on that message, as well as encourage local events around the country. But how can this become a broader message of unity, of multi-faith, to focus on climate justice and all of the racial injustice happening around Black Lives Matter? How can we bond and be more unified and work on that shift that we all need to work towards for this great turning.
I'm Michael Greenman from the First Unitarian Columbus, Ohio, and also the moderator going on and off. The moderator of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus, which probably most of you have not heard of. I hope some of you have. I've got an announcement about a program tomorrow, but I just wanted to thank the speakers who just came up and talked about the thing in Washington, the encyclical and the Pope, and also the interfaith need for us to work on of solving our environmental problem. Please come tomorrow to the workshop with Tom Hartman's workshop tomorrow at 3, because that's what we'll be dealing with, what Unitarian Universalists are already doing and will be doing to develop a strong interfaith national coalition that will find the solution to this based on our common understandings that we are, all of us, stewards of creation. Now my announcement, which unfortunately isn't very happy. Tom Hartman, and this just went off, but I can hopefully remember, Tom Hartman, who is the speaker tomorrow and who will talk about his book, The Crash of 2016, unfortunately, when he was in the airport in DC today, his wife Louise called and said he had a medical problem, and he had to go to the emergency room, and he will not be here tomorrow. However, we have, with the help of these good folks here, discussed what is happening tomorrow. David is very familiar and very close to Tom. He will be staying on. He was hoping to meet with Tom, but instead, he will take on the first part of tomorrow's session to discuss the crash of 2016. The bookstore has the book here in quantities, and it will be available. It's an amazing book that predicts that before the end of next year, we are likely to have another crash of the stock market. I thought Tom would, in the course of the book, say what we can do to prevent it. He doesn't. What he says is, here are the things we've got to do now and into the next few months to correct what has happened so we come out of it stronger and better and more united. And the number one suggestion he makes that you'll hear about tomorrow is to amend the Constitution to eliminate corporate personhood. Because that that is the primary element that causes climate change, in case you're not familiar with that. We'll talk about that tomorrow. So I had more to say about this. We will be here. David will be talking about a great deal of what Tom was going to say, and we will follow that up with a team of us that have organized this from Move to Amend and the Interfaith Caucus. Talk further about Move to Amend, in case you don't know what that is, and then the Interfaith Caucus, which was created 2 years ago in Louisville and is bringing together UU churches all around the country to spread out to other faiths to make this a national interfaith effort to turn our world around.
Fran, did you have, we're recognizing, we just went over, because we have a session, we were trying to go a little bit over the break to let you know about that. Fran has one other point. We'll take a break for about 15 minutes or so and come back. We had a video we were going to show you, but guess what? Life didn't work right, so we can't, but we will catch you up.